Unlock big savings and add style and security to your home with high-quality Schlage door locks from Menards. Whether you're looking for a traditional interior lock or a Wi-Fi-compatible electronic lock, Menards has you covered. With more than 200 options of Schlage door locks in stock, save big on all door locks. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another episode of Fantasy Fireside, where today we've had so many requests for this episode. It's been hotly anticipated. We are finally talking about the Frenchmen of Warhammer Fantasy, the Sigma males, the elf simps themselves, Bretonnia. And as everyone I'm sure knows, Colin absolutely has a lot to say about Bretonnia. So I'd just like to pass it on to Colin. We should get started. What do you think about Bretonnia?
Ah, well, I'm glad you asked. Well, you see, I think they suck. I hate them. They're stupid. They probably smell really bad. They're very fun. They're really fun to talk about. I love how I open a Total War game and I start as the Empire, and then half of the Western Empire no longer belongs to the Empire. It belongs to Lowen Lohenkar and his dumb, awful face. He shows up. Marienburg's no longer the Imperial. It's now belonging to Lohenkar. I really love how in a setting where part of the charm is you can see the different factions advance. You can see, you know, the Empire go through the Renaissance, the early Industrial Revolution, get gunpowder, get steel. It's really cool how Bretonnia goes, no, we're going to sit in medieval stasis for all of time. It's really cool how I think they're the only pantheon in Warhammer who are confirmed to be completely wrong. Like, you know, you got, like the Mechanicus, there's some debate over, like, you know, what is it, the Omnisci? Is it the Void Dragon? Is it the Emperor? Could he be his
Everything
own thing?
Everything works. Can say yeah, that.
It,
yeah.
It really could be anything. Bretonnia? No, they're just straight up wrong. The Lady of the Lake is not their god. It's an elf. It's not even the head of the elven god. It's the goddess of magic, Lilith. They're just completely wrong. They also get played by the Wood Elves, so, you know, listen, like I've said, I can respect some elf simping. They're just duped. They don't know they're doing it. They think they're all on their own, which is stupid and awful, and I hate them. Grail Knights are annoying. Nothing is quite as fun as watching their armies pump out 50 Grail Knights and then I explode. It's really fun in lore watching them explode. I hate them. They're pretty horrible all around. Marcus Kruger becoming a Grail Knight was the biggest character assassination I've ever seen in Vermintide. That was horrendous, and it made me want to cry. I really hate them, and I hope all of them get end times again. I hope the old world has a special segment where the entire country gets nuked by Skaven Warpstone.
Oh, so I guess, is that the episode done?
I mean, I can go on. I hate them. I hate them. I don't know if you knew that I hate them. They have one cool thing, which is Giles Le Breton. He's the only good Bretonnian, partially because he's dead, and the only good Bretonnian is a dead one. Other than that, let's see. They were too snooty for Sigmar, which is already something that's just a crime. The dwarves thought Sigmar was a cool guy, and if they thought a human was good, who are you to get on your high fucking horse and go, no, we're too good for Sigmar? They're just Arthurian legends, but ripped off, which, you know, you can say that about a lot of Warhammer factions, but at least they're changed up a bit. No, they didn't do that for Bretonnia. They just switched some names, and they didn't even switch some of the names. Giles Le Breton is just the Green Knight. You know, the Green Knight from King Arthur's story. Very cool. Very good story. I hate them. And in fact, you know what? I'm done. I'm not doing this episode. I'm out. I'll see you later. I quit. Wow. Have fun. Figure it out. Good luck.
All right.
Have fun.
All Only kidding, everyone. Colin didn't really want to talk about Britonia today. So I've actually got someone who's a bit of a fan about talking about Britonia, and it's his first time on Fantasy Fireside. So, Eli, how are you today? We're talking about Britonia.
Yes, we are. I'm very good. Thank you, Mr. Andy. I'm excited to talk about the one of the best factions in Warhammer that's, you know, gotten a little too much hate from our friend from our friend Colin. I think he's kind of spread the Britonia hate a little bit.
Yeah, so I'm here to
redeem them.
Okie dokie. Well, I'll try not to interrupt too much because it's a casual conversation. I know there's a lot to talk about. But before we talk about anything, like, why is it, I think they're one of your, is if it's not the most, one of your most favorite factions in fantasy, why do you like them so much? What's their draw?
They're just have such a, I'm a big fan of knights. Who isn't? I'm always, you know, chivalry and knights and honor and all that stuff has always resonated with me. I love that stuff. And Britonia is just that, ramped up to a million. It's just the Arthurian, you know what I mean? Knights of Arthur.
Arthurian legend, yeah.
Yeah. Basically just that, aesthetic. But in Warhammer. Their heroes are awesome. The good sides of it are really amazing. There's bad sides, obviously. But, I just like the heroes a lot, I think. And just the general, their whole general shtick is really fun and really cool. But I don't know if they're my absolute favorite in fantasy. It's close between the Dark Elves and the Vampires and then Britonia, probably something like that.
Fair enough.
I do love them. I love their aesthetic so much as well. It's like, I don't know if you remember, but there were these mega blocks, like Bionicle type knight guys. Yeah. And those were my freaking thing as a kid. I loved those so much. Stuck with me forever.
I'm seeing a strange amount of like people mentioning Bionicles in Warhammer videos these days. I don't know what it is. Just there's a trend going. There's a through line.
Bionicles are awesome.
Yeah, they are. So other than that, would you like to take it away? Where are we starting on this journey through Britonia?
We're going to go adventure into Britonia. Today is a somewhat basic overview of them, but it's a lot of things, but also basic. So should be nice and easy to digest, I'm hoping. Maybe I'll get my own beginner to expert and make 40 pages of lore someday.
We'll just hear Colin seething in the background. he can
do the beginner section and I'll do the expert section. It'll be real fun.
Fair enough.
Okay. So let's dive into our Britonia lore. Britonia is a land of heroes, my good friend. It is a land founded upon codes of honor and chivalry, a land fought for by heroes and unified in its vision. The Empire hides behind their black powder machines with no thoughts of honor, while nations such as Tilia pay off mercenaries to fight in their stead, not Britonia. Fair Britonia holds heroes like no other, great men and women who will charge headlong into darkness with no thought for themselves. Led by a demigod king who leads from the front, patrolled by superhuman paladins who slay whatever beast they find, and always watched over by the mysterious Green Knight, Britonia is truly a sight to behold. It is a feudal nation, employing a strict hierarchy with the king firmly on top. The king owns the entirety of the land and everything in it, and his word is final. There is one with more authority than him, though, and that is the Fae Enchantress, the emissary of the Lady of the Lake, Morgiana. Peasants sit at the bottom of this hierarchy, and some are oppressed, living harsh lives, while others live relatively good ones. The way Games Workshop writes Britonia makes it a little bit inconsistent, because their general lore makes you think that peasants have the worst life in all of Warhammer, and that they're the most oppressed group ever that you could ever exist or ever imagine. But then in the lore of a lot of the dukedoms, their lives don't seem that bad, and they just seem like regular peasants. So it's very hard to, I think it's really a case-to-case basis.
Well, if you were to compare them to, say, the Empire, do they have a better lot in life than the Empire, or is it kind of hard to say?
I think the majority of peasants don't have a better life than the ones in the Empire. But it depends on how you see it and where you live. Some of them might. It really depends on your outlook of life. They have very simple lives. They just farm and raise their families. And
you might not have a musket, but the air is clear. That's nice.
Yeah, they don't have to go, you know, work in ye olde Industrial Revolution factory for 15 hours a day and stuff like that. So, I mean, you know, pick your poison, I guess. But the regular peasant life in real life wasn't that bad. But this is Warhammer, so they have to make it bad. Otherwise, it's not Warhammer-y enough. Mm. So I guess take a regular peasant's life and just assume that it's worse because it's Warhammer. But there are also nice places in Bretonnia, so it depends. But I'll get into that right in a little bit.
But, okay.
Yeah. As I was saying, some are oppressed and they live harsh lives, while others live relatively good ones, theoretically. The people of this nation work together to further their land's glory. Each member of the hierarchy must perform their duty well for Bretonnia to thrive, and many fervently work towards this great goal. Nobles rule the peasants' lands and general towns, and these individuals will greatly determine the quality of life for said peasants. The most important laws in the land are the codes of chivalry. Many lords and ladies follow these tenets, yet some do not, as all human society has corruption. Those who do not follow the laws are generally spiteful and evil people who exploit their peasants to extreme degrees. Even with a good lord over the land, the general peasant populace still lives very basic lives. The Knights of Bretonnia are the best in the old world, some of them even possessing supernatural abilities. In service of the lady, knights and paladins wander the land, destroying evil and defending the weak wherever they go. The mysterious and powerful and all-powerful Green Knight operates out of thin air in the times of need to destroy entire armies by himself. Bretonnia is truly a beautiful place of green pastures, golden fields, and incredible architecture. It is home to some of the greatest heroes of Warhammer, whose deeds are literally unmatched by all in the old world. The knights are scores above the empires, and even the most skilled warriors of that nation would struggle to battle a single paladin of Bretonnia. And with that all said, I'll start with the history and general timeline of the nation.
Okay.
So, Bretonnia, do you have any questions, Andy, before
we end? When we were, so let's say we compare, you know, we're saying about the aristocracy ruling over the peasants. Mm. Are they majority quite fair and virtuous, or are they a bit more 40k corrupt? we'll just put the peasants through the meat grinder, screw them.
it depends. I think Games Workshop Games Workshop authors like to focus on the bad guys.
Okay. Or put it this way, like, for example, Colin absolutely adores Karl Franz because he just seems like a really nice guy. Is the equivalent of Karl Franz also a really nice guy who's like, oh, I'm not like the other nobles who are beating and flogging their well, their citizens?
The current king, Louis Liancourt, or Louis Liancourt, whatever. There's a lot of French names in this, by the way, viewers, and I'll mispronounce most of them, so just deal with it, I guess. But the current king is a very good and noble man. And in fact, he is willing to hear the pleas of all people, whether they be peasants or nobles. So if you have an issue, you can take it up with Lewin, although he's a very busy man. So, you know, but some of the nobles are really, I don't know if I should say most, some of the nobles are really good people. Some of them, of course, are just human beings in places of power. And so naturally they're bad people. It depends. But the knights, I'll explain why some of them are nice. But we'll get to that. So, in my opinion, I'd say it's probably like half and half. I don't know if that's real or not, but I'll let you decide once we're finished.
Okay.
All right, so let's get into the history. Bretonnia was founded on the shoulders of a great man named Gilles Le Breton. It might be Gilles, but I'm going to say Gilles, who united the Bretonni tribes. Before they even existed, though, the War of the Beard, which was the elves and dwarves, which I'm sure Colin taught you about earlier in your dwarf episode.
Yeah, we mentioned them in the dwarf episode. It was interesting stuff.
Yep, it was largely fought upon these lands, seeing the eventual defeat and exodus of the High Elves. Those who decided to stay would make the forest of Athelorn their home and become the Wood Elves. A tribe of druidic and agricultural people would wander to these new, now abandoned lands, and eventually the tribe of Bretonni people would come over the Grey Mountains, and they would displace the general orcs and druidic people. Sigmar would offer the Bretonni people to join him as he created the empire, but they would refuse and stay fractured for a long duration of time because their cultural differences were just too great, it would appear, to join the empire. But luckily for the Bretonians, or the Bretoni as they were this time, the dwarves still lived within the Grey Mountains, and with these neighbors, the Bretoni people would trade and find technological knowledge through the Dawi. It was in these early days of colonization and newly developed communities that the knightly tradition that would come to rule Bretonia came about. Each village or community had a great warrior whose only job was to train and protect his people. This warrior would eat the best meals, have a good living space within his watchtower, and be held with great respect. He would also have a strong warhorse. The ancient knight would be given the fairest maiden for a wife, and naturally this would bring about generations of genetic specimens. The knights were muscle-bound, hulking men whose skills of the blade were incredible and whose courage was that of steel. Of course, this life of comfort came at a cost, and the warrior would need to ride to battle against any monsters or raiders roaming the lands. As the communities advanced and grew, their warlords would become dukes, claiming their land as a dukedom, of which there were 16. And nowadays, there are only 50. Oh. But that's always a something I really enjoyed. Just the one guy tasked to be a knight over the entire village, and they just feed him all the food. He lifts all the weights, gets super jacked and juicy, and becomes a champion, basically. It's like a classic folk hero story, but it's in all the places in Bretonnia. It's a very cool tradition.
He's just like Gaston from Beauty and the Beast. He's like, I just eat all literally. This meat, and all the girls love me, and I'm so manly. Oh, look at me. I promise I'm not corrupt.
Yeah, literally. Now, the greenskins living beside the Bretonnies had amassed a war and descended upon the dukedom of Quillo and destroyed it, but not after the valiant knights fought to the last. Two close-by dukedoms went out to destroy the now lesser army and then turned on each other. But this started also a fairly good tradition. The nobles knew more life did not need to be spent, and they fought the first honor duel to decide the owner of the ruins of Quillo. For years to come, the lands would be plagued by wars from that of orcs, norskins, goblins, and beastmen. Bretonnia was beset on all sides by the forces of evil, but one man stood against it all, the Duke of Bastogne, Giles le Breton. He rallied three dukes to his banner, and they valiantly fought, but were defeated. Camping beside a lake, after a desperate battle, the fate of Bretonnia was decided. An ethereal and beautiful woman appeared to the knights, and Giles cried out, "Lady, wouldst thou bless mine banner?" And dipping the bloodied and tattered cloth into the lake, it came back to him, clean and emboldened with power. The icon of a golden grail lay upon it, and the remaining knights quickly had their arms blessed by the mysterious and clearly powerful Lady of the Lake. The warriors then drank from the cup given by the lady and were filled with incredible might. These were the first Grail Knights of Bretonnia, and they became the Grail Companions.
So that's where the bathwater jokes have come from, I suppose.
it's some good bathwater, though, because
it makes it good and strong.
Because we can see the power that they gained from it as the Greenskin army approached. It was vast as far as I could see, and they even blotted out the horizon. The small group of knights rallied around Giles as he raised his banner high, and they charged. It was as if they had become invincible, and that fate now shielded them as arrows streaked all around them. They crashed into the orcs' lines, wading deeper and deeper, never slowing the glorious advance and never faltering for a second. The greenskins were trampled beneath their feet and cleaved by their swords in a showing of impossible odds. Utterly terrified of these demigods, the orcs fled and the day was won. Perhaps the most heroic victory against all the odds was fought that day. From then on, the knights swore to serve the lady and to free Bretonnia. Giles was made leader of battles, and together the heroes would go on to fight for the glory and freedom of their people. So it was basically like 1,000-to-1 odds, and they just freaking Riders of Rohan went in there and, yeah. They're basically like, as far as Warhammer Fantasy go, I'm pretty sure these guys were like Primarch levels of crazy. Maybe not that far, but I mean probably. Primarch or at the least Chapter Master, but I think.
And is this like the very beginning of their kind of, because I know I'm still very uncertain about the timeline of everything that happens, but is this like the majority of the time they've been around, they've been the Grail Knights, or is this a more recent development in the timeline?
This was the like very beginning, basically.
Very beginning. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know the exact timeline, but this was the beginning of the creation of what has actually Britonia, because Britonia didn't exist yet. It was just like the dukedoms had just kind of formed, and now they've been invaded by orcs and beastmen and like a million other enemies.
Okay.
And the people were very desperate, and the place was basically, it was the end times for them. There wasn't much hope. These were kind of like the last guys around to do anything about it, and then they did.
And so, is this pre-Empire of Man or post?
I think it's around the same time.
Okay, so like two big factions just start to like burgeon as all this turmoil is going on, and it's like, oh, we'll do this thing, we'll do this thing. Yeah. Okay.
I don't know the exact timeline, because I don't know my Empire lore that good, but seeing as Sigmar offered to let the Britonian people join them before this happened, I'd say he was reuniting the tribes of the Empire people around this time.
Okay.
So, probably something like that. But this victory marked the beginning of a string of victories for the three Kirael companions. The first being Bordolo. The orc menace had besieged the port city, and so the companions swept in and slaughtered them all. It is said that the three Grail knights massacred more orcs than the entire army combined. I think I also said that Giles had three friends. I'm pretty sure he only had two friends, because they're the three guys.
But the three musketeers of sorts.
But they slayed. These three guys were worth an entire army, if not more.
Mm.
The lords of Bordolo and Aquitaine would join Giles, and the lady would appear to the gathered lords and bless the newcomers with the Grail. The first Grail chapel was erected in this spot. The heroes would then go on to win impossible battles all over Britonia, the lady appearing to the lords of each nation as they joined the Grail companions. The battles were fought on an insane scale, with the knights literally fighting hundreds to one and winning. I think one battle was 300-1 for their armies.
Wow.
They took the win. Giles even led his knights into Athol Lorn to fight the orcs, a largely untraveled place due to the rumors of a fey enchantress and her forest spirits. Said enchantress would lend her aid in battle. The fey enchantress, who is Galadriel, basically.
Okay.
But in another battle, Giles was struck low by a ballista and was then resurrected by the lady. And the rest of this history is entirely Grail Knights winning incredible battles, and each noble then being blessed by the lady to join the Grail Companions, eventually becoming the dukedoms that we have today.
Okay. But
at long last, the final battle arose, and they battled against armies of Chaos, Beastmen, Greenskin, and Skaven. The lady once again appeared and blessed the entire army, who, upon the fields of Coron, fought for their rights to live, and through weeks of battle and an ocean of blood, the day was won. The 12 dukedoms agreed to eternal peace, 15, I'm pretty sure, but whatever, and Giles became the king of Britonia. Through the years, he would continue to battle the forces of darkness, but would be suspiciously slain by an orc arrow.
Oh.
Very sad. It probably wasn't an orc. I can't see how.
He got resurrected from a ballista, but then an arrow got him.
Yeah. I don't know. You tell me. It was an orc arrow as well, so odds that an orc arrow actually killed him were pretty low. But as he died, he has to be laying on a raft. And within the mists of the lake that he was sent out on, it is said that he was taken by the lady. Giles' son, Louis, was crowned, but many debates arose of who deserved the throne. The young man took the pilgrimage to seek the lady and drink from the Grail, bringing the tradition of the questing knight. No individual was to become king or duke without drinking from the Grail. He returned, of course, and became king. I think I'm wrong, actually. I think no individual can become king without drinking from the Grail. I'm pretty sure a duke doesn't have to be a Grail knight.
You've got to get that power buff before you're allowed.
But he drank from the Grail and returned to become king. And he created the chivalric code. His father had lived by such codes, and Louis sought to make them the foundation of the kingdom. The codes contain 7 commandments that are as follows: to serve the Lady of the Lake, to defend the domains entrusted to him, to protect the weak and fight for the rights, always to fight the enemies of virtue and order, never to give up the fight until the foe be defeated, never to break faith with a friend or ally, always to display honor and courtesy. It also contains the rules of honor, which are: a knight may only fight hand-to-hand with sword or lance, he may not use a missile weapon, a knight shall always accept a challenge towards personal combat, a knight shall not draw a sword against his fellow Bretonian knights, except in trial by combat or within a tournament, a knight shall not allow himself to be captured alive, a knight shall not flee from the enemy nor retreat without proper tactical cause. So, pretty good foundations, I'd say. Naturally, I think if everyone followed these rules, Bretonnia would be a very nice place. But, you know, in any society, nobody follows all the rules, unfortunately.
You know what it reminds me of, though? I'm just working on my Blood Angels content this month, and it reminds me of the, they have the five, is it the five graces and the five virtues? And the five graces, I think they are honor, humility, mercy, restraint, and forgiveness. Ah. And then the counterpart is like, be strong, be savage, be detached, kill things. It's like, okay, fair enough. And that's like there, nice. But there's also the whole thing, they've got the grails and there's nobility. I'm like, that's an interesting parallel with Blood Angels and Bretonians. And Louis Dante, and very French, you know. Louis.
Nice. That's fun. Faith in the Lady became a key part of Bretonian society, and for a time, the codes of chivalry were upheld, and Bretonnia grew mightier by the day. The Fae Enchantress became the voice of the Lady, and her authority was absolute, acting as a religious figurehead for the people. This was Bretonnia's golden age. The Wood Elves would become their allies, and this gave Bretonnia great protection, as no one could invade through Athelorn. Moving on through the timeline, there is another series of conflicts. In a humorous parley between Tilian mercenaries and a few Bretonnian nobles, a man named Eto the Fierce challenged the Bretonnian knights to a joust, after the horsemen had insulted the Tilian skill in battle. The Tilians arrived with larger lances, a sex joke was made, and the Bretonnian knights went home ashamed.
Just reminds me of Jago Servetarian telling Corswain telling Jago Servetarian, like, yo, your mum lays with pigs. Like, oh, guys, come on.
Well, I think it was the Bretonnians made an emphasis on no enchanted weaponry, but the Tilians brought longer lances, which had nothing to do with enchantments. And then a Bretonian said, the Tilian lances are longer than the Bretonians. And the lady said, we know. And then they all laughed, and like, the knights were embarrassed. And
yeah. Mine is literally bigger than yours. Like, come on, guys. Get on with it.
And these were in the lands of Ravala, and they have not been fought over since. Going through the timeline, I've just highlighted a few things. I didn't want to put everything in because there's a ton of timeline stuff. But they went on a few crusades, classic, because nothing's original in Warhammer.
Very Warhammer.
And of course, these crusades were in Araby against a sultan. What a coincidence. But they fought alongside the Empire, which was cool. I think it was one of the first times that they fought with the Empire. So the Knights of Bretonnia and the Knights of the Empire fought beside each other against the Sultan Jafar and his forces of Araby. Jafar had invaded Istalia and was pushed back to his homeland, where the crusading knights breached the port city walls and utterly defeated him. They would then skirmish with the many tribes of Araby, and eventually, in the final battle, slay Jafar with the aid of Empire knights. They then left the desert lands, leaving the Empire to do with it what they wished, because the Bretonnians had no interest in sand and a place that's too hot. There's no farming to be done there, naturally. So,
where are we going to get the water for the grails? There's no water here. Oh, no.
Exactly. You can't have bath water if there's no water. So
exactly.
They had to go back. In later times, Thibault Dubois de Balzac.
Dubois?
Looks like Balzac is what it looks like. This guy's literally named Balzac. But he led his crusading force through the mountains, defeating numerous greenskin armies and receiving great honor from the dwarves. And these lands would later become the Border Princes, which are the yellow faction, I think, in Total War Warhammer. They got the yellow symbol thing, I think. Yeah, because they're not Marienburg. But they're still around today because end times don't exist. And yeah, so they're originally Bretonnian knights and lords, which is cool. At one point, this is something I think Colin has brought up before, but Borderlore was plagued by the Skaven.
Oh, yes.
And in a less humane but effective act, Baron Giscard Dupont torched the infected quarter of the city. And this naturally killed a large amount of people, but it did stop the plague. But the Skaven later attacked in full force, causing rampant disease to decimate the lands of Britonia and Tilia. The insane but powerful Duke Merovit of Musulon brought to the beginning of salvation, lifting the siege from Brionne. He later fought alongside other Bretonian forces as well as Athelorn, and the day was won. But the crazy Duke's madness was fully revealed in the Victory Feast, in which the nobles were witness to the Duke's shambling servants and morbid display of impaled criminals decorating his halls. And this is in Musulon, so in Total War, it's the Red Duke, but I don't think the Red Duke... I'm not sure if the Red Duke is actually a character, because the actual Duke of Musulon is the Black Knight, but it's close enough, I guess. Anywho, the king spoke out against Merovich, and they fought a duel eventually, but Merovich won, and he tore out the throat of the king and drank his blood. And I don't think he was actually even a vampire at this point, so it was just a really crazy guy. But then
he was just doing it for a flex, like, watch this.
So Merovich's kingdom was destroyed, though, and they killed him, naturally. After this, Great Crusades were launched during the Errantry Wars. Many were against the Orcs, with some being in the Far Off Lands and Araby against the Tomb Kings. There was a time when the Duke of Musulon deceived many into thinking he had the true Grail, but this was eventually revealed, and once again Musulon was sieged, and ever since then, there has been no officially recognized Duke of Musulon. The dukedom still exists, but the actual Duke is not recognized as a Duke. The rest of their history is just more conflicts against the various races of fantasy, so we can move on. At one point, Heinrich Kemlar invaded Bretonnia with all of his undead buddies. He's the evil wizard guy. So yeah, that's the general timeline of Bretonnia, because we're not going to talk about end times, naturally. I refuse to talk about end times, especially Bretonnia's treatment in the end times.
I'm assuming it was bad.
It was very bad. It was all bad regardless, because end times suck. But the one decision that they made that was nice during the end times was make the Green Knight Giles Le Breton. So that was cool. I'll talk about the Green Knight later, but that makes sense. I feel like they could have said that without it being the end times, though, anyways. So, but whatever. The rest of the end times, not canon. Only that one thing. But I'll talk about their hierarchy if I may.
Yeah, go for it.
So Bretonnia again follows the strict system of feudalism. The bottom, of course, are the peasants, who are generally sworn to fiefs ruled by lords, knights, and other such nobles. Like the knights of old, these peasants swear to serve the noble in exchange for their protection. They give 9/10 of their harvest to said noble,
and they have little tax rate. Jeez,
it's a lot. It's a lot, but you know, but they do have little to no rights for things such as reading, writing, education, freedom of travel, and marrying anyone of higher station, leading to inbreeding in a lot of areas.
Well, if you although put it like that, like, what are you going to buy? beer. That's about it.
Barley.
I can just buy beer.
Yep. Literally. I don't think they're allowed to travel to other dukedoms, but a lot of dukedoms have like populations that move around a lot, so I'm pretty sure they are allowed to travel sometimes. In other, it feels very inconsistent of how they
you
want
to. You need to have
these,
a very short quick expiration date passport to go from each dukedom to say, have you got all your stamps? Oh, have they all been you can't leave, sorry. Not allowed.
Rebellion is seen with extreme punishment, and a peasant who attacks a noble will find their family to be tortured and killed. Simple as that. You're not allowed to hunt in Bretonnia either, because naturally the king owns all of those animals in the land, and so if you hunt something, worst case scenario is the local lord will replace you with what you hunted and hunt you down instead.
Oof.
Do
they have problems with like feeding themselves though? Do the lords look after them and like here's like a bunch of potatoes and some water at least, or are they like no, we're struggling, we have to hunt?
It depends. A lot of peasants are pretty hungry fellas, but they keep their 1/10 of what they farm. And hopefully you had a bountiful harvest, so because that's what you got to feed yourself with, basically.
Yeah. Hope there isn't a famine going on, because then it sucks to be you, says the guy in his castle.
There are handouts sometimes, but they're pretty rare. When they happen, though, they're quite the big spectacle, and they're a very big deal when you're getting free stuff, obviously. Let's see here. The advancement in society is rare, but there's sort of a middle class of traders, doctors, and the likes, but they are still sworn to the lords of their lands and must pay their 9/10 of crops to said lords, but they generally do this in the form of currency instead. Most of these were given permission by their local lord to pursue these trades and specific learning areas, and they have general freedom of travel, but are still the property of the lord, and these individuals are fairly rare, from what I can tell. They're basically peasants, but doctor peasants and trader peasants and stuff.
Okay. Because
there's no actual distinction, I don't think.
It's just like one guy with a bucket of leeches, like, I'm a doctor. So I don't know. I'm a doctor. Just sticking one.
But yeah, so there's kind of a middle class. It's just France, obviously. Like, I'm sure you've probably gathered that by now. It's just old
there's just
France,
a bunch of boulangeries, and that's about it. Do you want some croissants? No, that's all we got. Sorry.
Yep. let's see. But they are slowly coming into existence. Other ways to possibly advance in this society would be to invent something incredible, such as the inventor of the trebuchet. But this is one of the only examples I can really give. Réponse de Lyonnais, who's Jeanne d'Arc, went from peasant girl to duchess of a dukedom. So, I mean, take what you will. Like I said, it's, the lore feels inconsistent, but it's fine.
With advancements, I do have a question, if I may. So the Empire's got muskets and gunpowder. Can they feasibly make them, but they just don't want to faff around with the technology and the infrastructure, or do they not know how to make them?
A little bit of both. Science isn't exactly a big thing in a society whose middle class is like non-existent, and they don't really have researchers and stuff as much. They have like monks and stuff, like abbeys, who naturally do their calligraphy and they write their scripts and stuff, right?
Okay.
But yeah, they just don't have people who would really work on it, and the other part is they have no interest in it because it is unchivalrous and very dishonorable. Use such weapons.
I suppose if your populace for the most part can't read, you can't give them an instruction manual how to load a musket, and then they're going to go, "Where's the others on the musket? No, there aren't. No, you can't milk it. It's a gun. What's a gun? Like, oh no."
They do use ranged weaponry sometimes. They just have the peasants do it because naturally, no knight can use a ranged weapon. That's very unchivalrous. But you know, the lowly peasants are, you know. It doesn't. I mean, they can do it. It doesn't matter.
That's kind of true to life. With, as far as I understand, like for example, when archery was developed, that was a big thing where the peasants could make it because they had loads of trees, and they were just like, "Oh, we can learn how to do this, and it doesn't cost so much." And all the knights were like, "What the fuck? Oh, my arm! Ow! What is this?" And they had it was like a massive shift where it gave loads of power to the peasants to be like, "Oh, we can just shoot the knights from range, and one of them's bound to hit like a gap somewhere." So,
yeah, I think it was the English longbows, and they were killing all the French knights. I'm pretty sure. Thankfully, that doesn't happen in this world because we have superpowers, so it works
and
out.
And guns. Hey!
But the people of the lower classes, they're not allowed to own gold, wear certain colors, have plate mail, or carry a weapon that would harm a knight. So the best you're probably going to get is like an axe.
Cheese knife.
Yeah.
You're not allowed too many pigs or cows. You've got a limit. Yep.
Literally. These smaller areas are usually entrusted to knights who answer to someone such as a baron. And these nobles also have a standing army of men at arms who are granted slightly better lives than the general peasantry, and some even get small pieces of land. They're just the peasants who can walk and aren't plagued by, you know, various mutations from inbreeding or ailments in general. Who aren't sickly, dying people. And so they find the fit peasants and they give them some armor and some shields, and then they go off and fight for good old Bretonnia. But their lives are probably a lot better. Well, they are a lot better than the actual normal peasants, it seems.
Yeah.
But the general populace of nobles are knights by rights and by law. If you're born into it, you have to follow it. You don't have a choice if you want to be a knight or not. So that's kind of a good thing. They follow the Lady of the Lake, and they must follow the codes of chivalry, and they must not use ranged weaponry. As I said, this is left to the peasants. Many of these lords and some knights are incredibly powerful and honorable Grail knights, while some are simply strong and good individuals. Some, of course, are corrupt, as it is within any human society. Along with these lords and ladies, there are various other random nobility, and I didn't really want to figure out all the different titles. Above these individuals are the dukes, who rule the dukedoms and have full authority over their subjects. At the top is the royarch, or king, who owns the entirety of the lands of Britannia, including everything and everyone in it. The king has a royal court, and generally only speaks to the upper echelons of society. That being said, the great man who currently sits atop the throne, Louis Liancourt, is willing to hear the case of anyone, no matter their station. Even above the king in authority is the Fae Enchantress, as she is the voice of the lady, and her word is respected above all in Britannia. In fact, it is the Enchantress who ultimately crowns the new kings, so it is the lady. And naturally, women are very well respected in Britannia, as their primary goddess is a woman.
Nice.
And the head of their state is a woman, so that is slightly different to, you know, old medieval times. Mind you, women, there are no women knights. That is a male-only profession. But they are women. The women are generally prophetesses or whatever. They're damsels, grail damsels, who are taught by the Lady of the Lake and the Fae Enchantress. So they have their own niche.
They're like caste, yeah. Like, I'm just like, oh, we're not quite like we're. There's like the lower class and the upper class, and we're like that weird middle class.
Yeah.
Splinter, just like, yeah, we do our own thing and we have privileges, fair enough.
Yeah. I mean, although Rapance is a woman and kind of a knight, I guess she's not technically a knight. I don't know.
She's the exception to the rule.
Yeah, theoretically. there's a lot of titles and a lot of mixing and stuff. I was reading, theoretically, Louis Liancourt is technically two people because he's the Duke of Coron, or sorry, of not whatever. He's the Duke of whatever the place is, the name I forgot, starts with the C. And he's also the King of Britannia at the same time.
But, well, I suppose, is it the current King of England? Is the King of England and the Duke of Normandy? Or has he passed that title on, maybe?
No, I have no idea.
I know, like, royalty in today's time even are like, I'm this and this and this. And it's like, oh, greedy. Yeah. Jeez.
But yeah, that's the general hierarchy, if that makes sense. I think it's, you know, just like a regular hierarchy. So, it's not, it could be worse. Naturally, the empire is a lot more bureaucratic, and most of the empire is more like middle class area, right? It's like, it's kind of like industrial revolution stuff, but not really, I guess, because it's not.
Like cyberpunk revolution. We've got guns, but we're still tilling the fields.
it's hard to tell. My empire lore needs to. I need to really touch up on all my fantasy lore. But yeah, it's much different than the Empire. It's the last nation of man who still uses feudalism, as everyone else has kind of moved past it or decided they didn't like it and all that stuff. So, their religion, you know, is the next most important part of their society, naturally. In Britannia, there is actually freedom of worship, with some individuals worshipping gods that are common within
chaos,
the empire.
I assume.
Yeah, of course.
No, not them. No. Put that down. Yeah, no, put that eight-pointed star down.
Yeah. More like, I don't know, Mor and Ashby, I think that's one of them. Stuff like that. The Empire's gods, the Tilians have their own gods, all that stuff. And you are allowed to worship whatever you want in Britannia. Sigmar is not generally one of these because he was a man, so you know the.
Oh, this is Elder Scrolls. This is Talos in Elder Scrolls. You're not allowed to worship Talos because he was a man. You're like, oh, come off it. He's a god now. I saw it. It's real.
So the Bretonian Inquisition, which from what I can tell is a thing that exists, which is fun. They don't like Sigmar too much, but you are allowed to, technically. You're just, it's kind of
it's frowned upon.
Not many people really do. Yeah. The only people who are worshiping Sigmar are generally people like who are from the Empire and now living in Britannia. But yeah, unfortunately, though, to worship a deity that isn't the Lady of the Lake is going to cost you a tax. And unfortunately, again, the peasantry are not allowed to openly worship the Lady of the Lake, as they are unworthy to worship her. So, but you know, of course, you have to worship a god. That's the law. So you know, if you're a peasant, you're just gonna have to pay the extra tax, I guess.
You can't be cheeky. I actually pray to the woman of the stream.
Unfortunately, not.
It's not quite. It's not Gucci. It's Gucky. It's slightly different, you know.
Although, it is Carone. I had the name right. I'm thinking Carcassonne. Although in Carone, or what was it? Let me see here. In one of the dukedoms, the peasants do actually worship the lady. It seems so. I guess it just depends on where you live.
I guess whoever's in charge gets to say, oh, this is allowed, this isn't, yeah, I'm in charge. Who's going to tell me no?
Yeah. That's, like I said, I guess it's inconsistent because each dukedom is going to have their own set of rules and laws. So you can't really blanket statement everything. Because the Britannia also has very vast and diverse geography and land. So all the dukedoms are quite different, and I'll get into them in a bit. But, anyways, as I was saying, despite this, the Cult of the Lady is still the largest religion in all of Britannia, because there's a lot of nobles and knights, I'm pretty sure. And while peasants do not openly worship her at temples and the likes, they still believe in her, and many will still pray to her in private. Overall, though, most peasants worship Shalia, a goddess of kindness and compassion who brings comfort to the hard life of a peasant.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Apparently, there's been heretical beliefs that Shalia is actually just in a another form of the Lady of the Lake. It's just another apparition that she takes on, which, of course, the good old Inquisition isn't a fan of that. So get that out of here. The Cult of the Lady consists of the noble populace and middle class, if you can really call it a middle class, because I'm still not sure.
But slightly those, upper and lower class.
I guess. Those who are not lords must pay a tax to the lady, and tithing is optional, of course, for higher-ranked nobles. But, you know, the knights have to tithe. All knights aspire to one day meet the lady and sip from her grail. They uphold her honor. All right, okay. Uphold her honor and defend the good name of the lady wherever they go. Most knights are zealous and fervently follow the lady, and the Grail Knights are the greatest amongst these. And you go, I believe it goes, you start as a like errant knight, just as a little guy, and then you go as a questing knight, which is, you know, you're going on your quest to find the lady, and then you become a Grail Knight. And a knight of the realm fits somewhere in there as well.
Do they have, squires who have their own little bonuses? Like, oh, you're a squire for a knight. It's, better than a peasant.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, technically, a peasant can be anything that their noble wants them to be. So maybe you might get to be a lucky peasant and
Swords and stuff.
Squire to it, yeah.
Clean his greaves. Real lucky.
Yeah, so Grail Knights have sought and found the lady and have been directly blessed by her, drinking the lifeblood of the land from her grail, and they gain supernatural powers. These Grail Knights are complete heroes whose honor and nobility is unquestionable. They are the epitome of Britannia, the perfect image of the nation's ideals. These men are bound to the lady and the Fey Enchantress, and many roam the lands, slaying monsters and defending the weak, while others go to serve within a lord's army. Many are paladins. I mean, and technically all Grail Knights are paladins, but paladins are also their own thing. And paladins are individually blessed with superb might and martial skill, who are leagues higher than most knights of Britannia and easily greater than the best warriors of the Empire. Grail Knights are like actual space marines. If you put a space marine in Warhammer Fantasy, then they'd be the Grail Knights.
Okay.
And they also have, like, on the tabletop, they have a ward save, which is a save you can take against, like, anything. So, like, let's say a trebuchet shot hits your knight. If you roll your 5+, he'll be okay. So he just took that trebuchet to the face.
It's but a scratch and just wipes his arm. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
What's that best you got? Come on.
They basically gain plot armor, and so missiles and ranged weapons just kind of don't hit them, or if they do, they just bounce off from magical powers and stuff like that. And they have incredible vigor. They can fight for like days on or hours on end and without tiring. They're just superhumans, basically, in Warhammer Fantasy.
Please tell me their armor is called Grail Mail.
if only. But it helps, since, you know, we don't have guns and stuff in Bretonnia, then you might wonder, like, how are these guys not just, like, dead and worse than the Empire? But it's because they have all the crazy knights and stuff. And I mean, to be fair, they are mostly fighting, like, beastmen and undead and orcs who, on their own, aren't going to have... They don't have the guns or whatever anyways. It's not like the Bretonnians really fight the dwarves or anything, so that... Power levels kind of works in their favor in those aspects, and a cavalry charge is pretty scary. So
yeah, and I suppose, to be honest, even though it's like guns, they are muskets. So even if you got really good armor, I guess you could probably take a few hits and it would ping off, or it would only like dent your plate a little, and you go, "Oh, that wasn't so bad." Cleave them in half, you know.
Yeah, as long as basically, as long as you're not going against some dwarf like thunderers and cannons
with a massive blunderbuss. Pointed in your face with the unprotected visor, like, oh, that's not good.
Gyrocopter bombs and stuff. The dwarves are OP, but there's not many of them, I guess, which is why they aren't the rulers of Warhammer. They once were, which I guess Colin probably talked about that too. So you guys can go watch the Colin episode on dwarves for Fireside Fantasy, but I'll get back into Bretonnia. As I said before, the Fae Enchantress, also known as Morgiana the Fae, is the Lady's voice and holds absolute authority over the nation. She is a powerful magic user who, through reincarnation, has lived for thousands of years. Morgiana mentors the damsels of the Lady as she finds magical use within the lands and takes them to a mysterious other world, which is where the Lady of the Lake resides. She occasionally takes males, and they are never heard of again. So...
I don't know. I'm just like, what's she doing with them? What's happening?
Yeah.
There's got to be some propaganda like, oh, I'm going to be chosen. No. And then you find out what happens and it's just terrible. Like, oh, no. Give me a kiss.
Yep. I don't know if they ever reveal what happens to the males that she takes. But basically, if you're the magic users in Bretonnia, when they're kids, you know, if they can see the future, or, you know, food gets rotten when they're beside them, or weird things like that, the Fae Enchantress will usually visit them before they go through puberty, or during, one of the two, just when they're young, and she'll take them, and their family mourns them, basically, and acts like they're dead, even if they come back. But even if they do come back, they are kind of just, they must serve the Lady, and... Here, I was talking about them right now. I have it right here. Damsels, as I said, are those children taken by Morgiana and trained to realize their true potential. And they are highly respected within Bretonnian society and are their magic users. Grail damsels have a complete autonomy within the land and serve only the ladies. Their powers harness the forces of nature to aid the Bretonnian armies, generally shielding them from evil and healing their wounds. They also act as priestesses of the Lady and advisors to noble. So they have a pretty nice position. Obviously, they can quite literally do whatever they want and just go wherever they want.
Just get away with it. Like, yeah, I do what I want. You got a problem? Talk to the lady. Oh, no. You're not going to talk to the lady? No? Okay. Well, get out of my way.
The Enchantress herself, though, is probably one of the most powerful casters in all of Warhammer. Probably only rivaled by guys like Teclis, because...
Okay. You know, oh, I was going to ask.
Like, just OP.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it like just elves? Because elves are usually quite magic, good at magic.
Yeah. But the Fae Enchantress is pretty elfy, so, you know, she's pretty high up there.
She's elf light.
Yeah. Said that she can kill you with a glance, basically. Oof. So She's pretty strong. She's certainly the most powerful caster in the old world, easily, for sure. And she rides to war with her Grail Knights in the times of dire need. So moving on, unless you have any questions.
No, I'm good to go. It's interesting.
Swiftly talk about the armies. The armies of Britonia generally consist of a lord, a paladin, a damsel, valorous and skilled knights, great trebuchets, men-at-arms, and, when the situation calls for it, scores of peasantry. The kingdom does not technically have an actual standing military, and the armies are created usually through calls to war. The king will call upon a baron, who will call upon his lord, who will call upon his knights, who will call upon his men-at-arms and peasants, and so on. In any conflict, it will be common for the Bretonian force to have far more cavalry than the enemy, and they often rely on the great trampling charge that comes forth from these knights. Obviously, the hammer and anvil tactic is also employed greatly, as the somewhat armored and trained men-at-arms hold the enemy at bay for the knights to crash into their flanks. There are no cowardly weapons such as cannons or guns within these armies, and only peasants will have bows or man the trebuchets, which are tolerated. When one has the blessing of the lady, they need no such things, as oftentimes ranged attacks will simply miss them or be deflected by the magical properties granted to such knights. The peasants are naturally not overly useful for much more than being bodies with weapons, and they usually just make for at least a good distraction, but under the authority of a proper and chivalrous knight, they may be pushed to some degree of actual martial skill, however small it may be. Each peasant must learn how to fire a bow, and the lucky ones get to use this skill instead of being sent to the front line.
Just like a big spear. Just like, here they come. Oh, no, just hold it in front of you, Gary. It'll be fine. I don't like it. Poor guy.
That being said, though, the peasant bowmen and peasants in general do have to bring their own gear to the battlefield. So,
their own gear that they've bought with their 10% of like profit from their tithe. Like, oh no, worshipping the lady and they're actually paying 95% tax plus the possible tax wherever the Duke is like, oh, by the way, we're doing a water tax, so that's another percentage. Like, oh, I can buy myself a slingshot. Brilliant.
Yep. A lot of taxes. It probably depends on what lord you have in the land. I'm sure there's a good chance that some knights or lords will provide their peasants with something. It's encouraged for them all to learn how to use bows, like, just from a young age, and I assume they probably know how to make bows at that point. And if not, they likely get some equipment every once in a while, but yeah, generally they're showing up with the clothes on their back and the pitchfork from their backyard, so... You know, it works. They stand in the way for a little bit for the trebuchets to shoot at the enemy or the knights to charge.
I know you said they don't have like a standing army as such, but as far as scale goes, I know the peasants probably are the vast majority. Are they like equal in terms of size to the empire or a bit smaller? Or no, like, is there a good way to explain
I believe Britonia is one third the size of the empire.
Okay.
Something like that. One third or one quarter. They are the largest nation of man, second to the Empire.
Mm. And so, they are nowhere near as many as the Skaven or the Orcs.
No, definitely not. But as obviously, one Grail Knight is equal to like literally 1,000 Skaven. So yeah, it works out. But yeah, that's the general armies. They're not overly complicated. They're fun though. I think I'll talk about the heroes now. Before I talk about all the dukedoms, because the dukedoms are a little bit less exciting.
Okay.
Unless we'll do that. I won't save the best for last. I'll save the best for right now. So, probably one of the more important heroes, the cooler one, in my opinion, is the Green Knight. There's not much on him because he's a pretty mysterious individual. He just has done a lot of really epic things, like 1v1s. Or like 1v5s giants, basically, and defeats entire armies. But he is the sacred protector of Britonia and the judge that tests all questing knights who seek the Grail. He is a mysterious and ghostly being who appears at random whenever he is needed most. He contains the power to rout armies and slay the champions of every variety. The Beastmen call him the Soul Killer, and he is rightfully feared by the mutants. It's a pretty freaking
I've had another Blood Angels comparison with him and the Sanguinaut, to be honest. I'm like, he turns up occasionally. He's kind of ethereal. He's really you're strong.
Right. You're right.
Ooh, but he's not red and gold. Okay.
He's green. He's kind of like Grombrindal. I don't know if Colin talked about
Santa a little Claus bit, dwarf. I think, yeah.
Grombrindal just kind of shows up when he's needed and then kicks butt and leaves.
Yeah. Although I know the Sanguinaur is like, he's really, really strong, but he doesn't actually try to like decimate his enemies. He's more like, I'm a helping hand, and he doesn't actually turn up that often. And he doesn't just go, and we won an overwhelming victory, because that's not his style. He's like, no, I'll just like chip in, because I'm not supposed to do all the heavy lifting. You're like, oh, why not? I don't know, because I'm the Sanguinaur.
I believe on the tabletop, the Green Knight has the ethereal rule. So you can't actually wound him unless you have a magical weapon.
Wow.
As long as that rule stayed the same from when I played Warhammer Fantasy.
Okay. So but, if you just like insert him in the middle of someone's army and they're like, I've only got melee units. Like, oh, well.
Yeah basically. Because he's a ghost, basically. Mm. Ghost or demon or apparition or something weird like that. It's
Who
not
you
really
gonna call? Charles Leprechaun.
Yeah, truly. Yeah, it's not really explained what he really is, but it works. It's also not really ever explained who the Lady of the Lake, like what she really is until the end times. And like I said, we don't talk about the end times, so it's not, it doesn't count.
Okay. she's just but, not, she's not an elf.
Yeah, that's right.
Definitely not. Can't be, no.
You know, even if she is an elf, I'm not even, like, it's okay. Honestly, I'm not even if she's an elf. It's just, in the end times, I'll briefly say, the end times from what I remember, basically, the elves said that Britonia is just a meat shield for chaos, and they tricked them into just being there so that the elves could fight chaos after them. From what I can tell, that's what it was, and that sucks. Just bad writing. Whatever. The end times didn't happen. We all know that. Old World's coming back.
It's just a bad dream.
I see Britonia on the front cover of Old World, so you know what?
Nice.
I think we're winning. I think we're winning right now. Anyways, though, back to the Green Knight. When a questing knight goes out for the Grail, he will eventually be approached by the Green Knight, and they will duel. The young man must defeat the Green Knight to receive the Lady's Blessing. Of course, the Green Knight could slay them in an instant, but the battle is more about testing their strength and valor and honor. And so he kind of gauges what kind of person they are and how they fight and if they're really worthy of receiving the blessing of the lady. And then that's kind of more of how you win the battle, more so than actually being more powerful than the Green Knight. Because obviously the Green Knight would, like, that wouldn't work. He would just kill you. But
it kind of reminds me of Azrael in the Dark Angels, when he becomes Chapter Master, there's these weird spectral knights that come from the banners, and they're like, who do you serve? And they start attacking him, and he's like, the Emperor? They're like, no, who do you serve? Humanity? No. And they just like start battering him. He's like, just the Dark Angels. I only serve the... And then they're like, then they recede. You're like, oh, it was just a test to be like, they're more important than the Emperor. They're more important than the Imperium. The Dark Angels are the most important thing. Don't forget. You're like, oh.
That sounds like how the Horus Heresy happened.
Yeah, a little bit.
Wow. But that's the Green Knight. He's pretty cool. He's pretty badass on the tabletop, and he's really fun to use in Total War. Because you just get this little button, and then you can put him down wherever in the enemy army, and he explodes and comes out and kills everybody, and he's pretty awesome. I have a PDF of the.
And he goes bang bang bang, and then he disappears.
I have the PDF of the Britonian army book, but it's on one of the websites that makes you watch an ad before you can see a single freaking page. So, we'll go without his rules for now. That's okay. He'll come back in Old World, though. I sure hope. I really, really hope.
I mean, but, I assume he's like the flagship unit. Like, he's the most popular thing from the faction, or at least the most iconic. I would say.
Probably. It's either him or the guy who I'm going to talk about next.
Okay.
Who is Lewin Leoncur. And he is the current king of Britonia. And from what I can tell, the most powerful man alive by a long shot. Like, you put Carl Franz in front of this guy, and he folds Carl Franz in two. And just, like, kicks him like a ball over their neighbor's fence and leaves him there.
Wow.
From what I can
tell. I'm sure Colin will have some words about that statement.
maybe my Karl Franz lore isn't read up upon, but I'm pretty sure Karl Franz is just a guy.
Yeah.
Who has kind of the blessing of Sigmar.
He's just a swell guy who's doing his best.
Yeah. In the end times, Karl Franz gets super strong, but this isn't the end times, so I'm going to keep going. As a young man, Lúin took the questing vow, and he was younger than perhaps any before him. And for many years, he wandered Bretonnia, slaying beasts and lending his aid to all those in need. He was a paragon of chivalry, defending all no matter their situation. In these days, they called him Lioncoeur, which is lionhearted. During one of his quests, he rescued the prophetess Carolinda, and she blessed him, giving him superhuman strength. He later fought none other than the Green Knight himself in his duel to prove himself. And their duel was intense and legendary, and after a grueling battle, Lúin proved himself worthy and defeated the apparition. He actually cuts the Green Knight's head off, and then the Green Knight kneels down and picks his head up and puts it back on.
Like, I'm just imagining him just putting his hat, like patting the floor, like, where's my head? I can see out my eyes, but I can't see where they are in relation to my body. And just goes, it's like, that's never happened before. Sorry, this will only take a minute. Click.
There's a nice moment where the Green Knight knocks Lúin off of his horse. And so then the green guy gets off of his horse as well, as he, you know, is very chivalrous.
He's like, don't forget honorable. The chivalry. That's the whole point.
He would later find the lady herself and gain her blessing. He drank from the grail and his power became absolute. Some people even say he got a little smooch from the lady.
Ooh.
Possibly. At least at some point in his life.
Just a little,
yeah.
Say, oh, I like you. Very good. And then the Green Knight's like, I didn't get a kiss.
Tough stuff. But for the next 40 years, he continued to quest throughout the land. And yet, Grail Knights, from what I can tell, are essentially, they're either immortal or they age at a much slower pace.
Yeah.
Because one of Giles' buddies died when he was like 160, and he died in battle. So.
And he was a Grail Knight, right?
Yeah. He was one of the Grail Companions, even.
Oh, wow.
Which I guess are more powerful. But yeah, anyways, he quested for 40 years throughout the land, again defeating the greatest foes he could find, and growing ever higher in the lady's favor. And finally, he returned home to inherit the throne of his father, who had passed away. He first reinstated the Grand Tournament, which drew in the mightiest warriors of the land, yet no one could defeat Lúin. So every knight, basically, every most skilled knight from every dukedom came to fight Lúin, and they lost every time. And I don't think it was only fighting either. I think there were multiple events. So he's already proven himself to just be, like, crazy.
It's like chess boxing. It's like, we'll have a quick duel, and then we're going to do, like, throwing javelins at targets, and then we're going to have a quick game of what's it called? Where it's like the army game. Ruse? Is it Ruse? No.
Risk?
Risk. We'll play a quick game of Risk, and then we're back on the horse. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah. Jousting.
There's a game show where it was just probably just America thing. It was like a Wipeout. He was a
Wipeout. There's a UK version as well. Yeah, yeah.
I like to think Bretonnian knights were doing stuff like that.
Or like Takeshi's Castle, just like, oh, he's going to fall off the thing. Oh, dear.
He proved his skill in all aspects of kingship, politics, warfare, trade, and the likes. Time and time again, he has led his armies to victories against every single threat posed to his kingdom. Not once has the king broken the vows of chivalry, and he is willing to hear the pleas of any of his subjects, be they peasant or lord. From what I can tell, he has never been defeated ever in all of Warhammer history. He is essentially immune to magic, and I don't think he is even human anymore. Whenever he is wounded, shining liquid light pours forth from his body, and the wound is healed immediately. So
I think he's basically
like a demigod at this point.
I'm assuming this is all because of that grail water. Like, you got a good gulp of that stuff, made him well strong.
Bath water and a smooch, and that's all you need.
Yeah, it was the kiss that did it. It was like, just the kiss was enough to make him be like, for the lady! And
it's like a Looney Tunes type of cartoon. He like flies up a little bit.
With his acne sword, like, yeah, let's go.
So he's basically immortal and nearly invincible and just stupidly powerful. He is also, again, from what I can tell, never lost a single battle within war, leading his armies to victory as his long life and many blessings have granted him wisdom beyond any other mortal generals. He has proven himself a pristine diplomat as well, being buddies with Mr. Karl Franz, and he's trusted and honored by all the forces of good within the old world. A little bit about his war gear. He has the Crown of Britannia, and it shines with the lady's blessing to inspire everybody around it. On the tabletop, I think it basically made you, everyone within 12 inches or something, or 18 inches, immune to panic, which was just like their running away check. That makes sense. His blade is known as the Sword of Coron, and has been passed down through generations, and has been enchanted by the mirror pools of the Great Forest, and shines with a blinding and burning light. His shield is the Lion's Shield. It has been blessed and reinforced time and time again, and gives him incredible protection against magic. Atop his hippogriff...
Not to be confused with the Lion's Shield in 40k, which is actually the Emperor's Shield. Correct. Not that Lion's Shield, it's this Lion's Shield, yeah.
That's right, this one's cool. atop his hippogriff, Biaki, he rides to battle. He is raised Great Steed from birth, and it is as capable a warrior as any knight of the nation. So, on the tabletop, Louis' rules, let's see, he has the Puissant Virtue, and while he's fighting and challenges, he can reroll any failed rolls to hit or to wound, but he must always accept the second result. Lewin also counts as having the Virtue of Purity, which is just another rule. He's beloved son of Britannia. If he's removed as a casualty, all Britannian units must take a panic test. They all, for the rest of the battle, they count as being stubborn. And then he's the army of the king when he goes to war. The finest warriors of Britannia march with him. The 0-1 restriction on Grail Knights is lifted. When Lewin is general, however, men-at-arms and bowmen become special choices. So he can take a whole bunch of Grail Knights with him, but you can take less men-at-arms and bowmen, it looks like. Okay. Which is pretty cool, I think. He's the lady's champion, so he bears a blessing even more potent than others who have sipped from the Grail. He will always have the blessing of the lady, even if the army did not pray. Oh, yeah, you had to pray before your... Oh, that man... Warhammer Fantasy was so cool. What the heck? How did they get rid of this stuff? In addition to the ward save he receives from the blessing, Lewin Kerr has regeneration, so he gets his wounds back. However, the lady's code is so integral to his nature that if Lewin Kerr flees for any reason, fails to rally, or refuses a challenge, he will immediately take a wound with no saves of any kind allowed, and will lose the blessing. He will, however, maintain his regeneration. All right. So moving on to his items. The Crown of Britannia. It's looking like, yep, friendly troops may use his leadership characteristic when he is within 18 inches, and any unit with line of sight to him is immune to panic. That's pretty good. The Sword of Coron. So the sword confers +1 strength. In addition, any foe in base contact with Lewin at the beginning of any close combat must take a leadership test. If this is failed, that model may make no attacks this round and will be hit automatically, because it says that it shines with a dazzling, blinding light. Then finally, the Lion's Shield counts as a normal shield. In addition, Lewin has a magic resistance value equal to the total number of dice used in the casting of any spell that affects him. This can exceed the normal limit for magic resistance. For example, if a fireball is targeted at Lewin using 4 dice to cast, he will have magic resistance 4, so he gets 4 opportunities to cast. And I believe you just had to roll like a 6 on it or something. Wow. So that's pretty cool. He has some cool rules, naturally, unsurprisingly, as he should. But moving on to just one more hero, because I figured I shouldn't talk about every single Britannian noble to ever exist. And also because there aren't actually many, I think a lot of the heroes were actually made for Total War. They existed in the lore, they just didn't really have rules, I don't think, from what I can tell, just looking at it. But my favorite Britannian, who I talked about a little bit earlier, is Ponce de Leonesse, who is literally just Joan d'Arc in Warhammer. And I'm a big Joan d'Arc fan, of course. Nice. So in the times of old, this was before Lewin Leonkerr, I believe, Coron had been invaded by chaos and largely destroyed, seeing the current king slain. As the raiders dispersed through the fair land, Rapunzel's village within Lioness was attacked. The lady appeared to Rapunzel and told her to drive the evils from the land. So the young peasant girl opened the local Grail Chapel, took the sword, and of course a fleur-de-lis banner. And she also donned a set of plate armor from a dead knight and mounted a loose warhorse. and rode to battle. Seeing such bravery from a peasant girl, the knights were convicted and took up arms to follow her. Their armies crashed through the forces of Chaos, and with the lady's blessing all around her, Rapont slew the enemy Chaos Lord and saved the nation. She would become the Duchess of Lyonesse, gifted to her by King Louis the Young. So, peasant to duchess. That's pretty cool.
Nice.
It's very... Yeah, Warhammer's not very original, but that's
whenever I think of Joan of Arc, I think of Bill and Ted. In the first movie, she joins the band and they go adventuring and she's like, oh, and then she's praying. All of a sudden, there's the telephone box and they just reach out and she joins them. And then they go for the shopping mall and she's like dancing to stuff and trying to fight the security guys. I'm like, oh, Joan.
I've not seen this. Oh,
the first movie, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, she's in it. It's good fun.
Nice. I'll check that out. That sounds fun. But yeah, those are some of the highlights of the heroes. I'm a big fan of them. I talked about Morgiana earlier, the Fey Enchantress, so she's obviously a very important one. She rides upon a unicorn, I'm pretty sure, or a Pegasus. Mm-hmm. I know it's a unicorn. It's totally a unicorn. Because the damsels sometimes ride on unicorns, which is fun. Lastly, I have the dukedoms to talk about.
Cool.
And I only wrote a little bit of them because there's 15 of them.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to, bore you all with my geography lesson. I think they're all pretty cool, but I only did a little bit. So, but where I'm going from north of Bretonnia to south of Bretonnia, and starting with Corone, this is probably the one Colin makes fun of the most because they really like horses. But
is it also the closest to the Empire? Like geographically, I'm trying to think where it is.
No, that would be, I think it's Paravon.
So they're not all like clustered in like one landmass, is it? Are they just all over the place?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
They're all just on the Bretonnian province, country. Yeah. They are all on the same country, though.
But, okay, right.
Yeah, I'll put a map up on the footage.
Cool.
Corone is the Bretonniais Dukedom, and is ruled by current king Lewin Leon Kerr. They have the best horses in the entire land, which is naturally saying a lot, as Bretonnian horse stock is already extremely high quality everywhere else. The people of this land are obsessed with horses, and the culture has even become part of their politics. Instead of an assassination attempt or political ploy, a rival will instead try to sabotage their enemy's horse in a horse race. Yeah.
Okay.
And that'll be, yeah.
Is it confirmed that's like, are there laws where you're not allowed to injure a horse? Because I like, for example, when I think of, is it India where they're not allowed to injure cows and such because they're sacred? It's like, is that the case where Bretonnia is like, oh, if you're a peasant, you're not even allowed to like impede a horse just grazing anywhere? It's like, no, it's important. Leave it alone.
That's a good question. I don't actually know, but I wouldn't be surprised if that was a thing. But even peasants in Corone, though, generally have ridden a horse before, which is nice. But so these people allegedly are riding horses before they have even learned to walk, and the best knights usually come from this dukedom, naturally. Moving down, I guess I should say, we have Le Anguille. Again, I'll probably say many of the names wrong. I don't care. I'm not French.
So. It's French. It's difficult.
Yeah. This is the oceanic dukedom of Bretonnia and lies on its northern shores. As a result, it is one of their trade hubs containing a great port city. Much of the wealthier middle class resides here, as it is ripe for trade and potential. It is shielded by its neighboring dukedoms and bears a good weather, meaning fruitful harvests for its beautiful countryside away from its ports. So it consists of two different types of people, the city people and the countryside people, basically. And it's the classic countryside, like, oh, those dang city slickers have never worked a good day in their life type of thing.
They don't know how to use a plow up in those cities in their office blocks. They've never worked. No calluses on their fingers. I wouldn't trust them as far as I could throw them.
Lyonesse is an entire dukedom of petty schemers. The lay of the land has allowed these people to erect vast and impregnable fortifications, giving them essentially no external threats. As a result, with no enemy to fight against, they turn to each other to sate their need for conflict.
Oh.
The rivalries last generations, and the dukedom will likely never gain unity. Lyonesse is massive, and many of its villages are actually upon islands. It is sad to see them in such disunity, though, as the dukedom has a rich history and has fought many valiant battles, where Ponce was from, Lyonnais as well.
So how does that work with their chivalric values if they're always in fighting? Is it just, oh, we're allowed to be a bit naughty as long as we don't, like, spit in your eyes or, like, do anything or stab you in the back? Or
I mean, they're not really supposed to fight at all, so this is one of the examples of a less chivalric people.
Pushing the limits of chivalry, like, oh, I didn't throw you down the stairs. I merely tripped you down the stairs. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. And there weren't caltrops on the stairs either, so it could have been worse. Like, don't know, mate.
Yeah, basically. But Thiorulf the Lionhearted was said to be Giles' most loyal companion and even married his sister, and he's from Lyonnais. So truly, it is very sad to see the state that they are now in. Artois is a dukedom almost entirely covered in forest. The majority of its populace resides in the small section of open land, but some villages lay within the dark woods. Within these woods lurks many great beasts and foul beastmen of chaos. The people who live in the open land are hardy and adventurous, while those residing within the forest are isolationist to the extreme. So dangerous is the forest that the people hold funerals for those who leave and assume they are undead if they ever return.
Oh no.
Good old superstitious Bretonians.
I'm assuming they're quite superstitious then.
Yeah, quite. This place is home to some of the most noble and good men to be part of Bretonian nobility. They fight hard against the evils, and many treat their peasants very well. One particular baron even brings his peasants to L'Anguil every year. So, nice guy. That's a good example. It was a bad example in Lyonnais, and now Artois is a good example of actually good.
Yeah, go from one end of the spectrum to the other, like, oh, scumbags, and then Paragon. Lovely. Yeah.
And naturally, when your village in the woods is being attacked, like, once a year at least by beastmen, everybody needs to know how to fight and be in generally decent condition to, if they want to survive.
So. And you're going to grow bonds of friendship and camaraderie. Like, oh, I remember when we, like, cut off that beastman's head a year or two ago and you saved my life. Yeah, you're my best friend. You're my best friend. It's like, yeah, no, you're my best friend. You looked after my horse when I was on holiday. You're my best friend. No, you're my best friend.
Truly. You'd make a good Bretonian, clearly. Yeah. Gizero, I don't know how to say it.
Gizero, maybe? I don't know.
Sure. It is a dukedom with a diverse geography, and as a result, home to multiple different cultures. Farmers, trappers, woodsmen, and mountaineers reside within their respective regions, and the people of the dukedom are kind and welcoming, granting shelter and a good meal to any visitors who come through their lands. Montfort is a dukedom almost entirely residing within the Grey Mountains. They sit between Bretonnia and the Empire, so this is one of the ones that would be closest to the Empire. I think there's three passes through the mountain, and then there's three dukedoms that are on the mountain, and those are the ways to get to the Empire, basically. The people of Montfort are tough and harsh, and they live in hostile conditions, constantly battling against greenskin invaders. And they have a hatred and distrust for all beings non-human, so even dwarves and elves and halflings, they just don't like them.
Because is that just specifically them, or does Bretonnia have a weird, like, because you mentioned about how they work with the dwarves. Are they actually quite chill when it comes to other species, or are they like, no, we don't like them?
I think they're pretty good. Because they work with the dwarves and the wood elves sometimes. So the wood elves, the Bretonnian, like, nobles, the greatest knights are some of the only ones allowed to ever enter into Athelborn. Yeah, like 99% of other human beings who enter Athelorn are never going to come out because the wood elves are very...
I mean, to be honest as well, if you think of like an Empire guy just walking in, he smells of soot and he's been working in the factory. He's like, oh, you're bringing in like smog into the... get out of here. Go and have a bath. Come on.
Yeah. One of these dukedoms is actually like has part of the Athelorn forest in their dukedom, and the wood elves let them be there. So
that's nice.
Kind of neat. But yeah, that'll come up. Mousselon is the spooky, wooky, dark, and bleak dukedom. It has lost its official status and has no recognized ruler. Malnourished mutant beings reside here, and the lands are covered in swamp. The most healthy individuals are those who come from the outside, and these are generally the scum of humanity who come to seek shelter in the one place no authority would care enough to follow them in. Oof. It is a horribly miserable place and run down and just disgusting. Many of the nobles of this land have reigned for suspiciously long amounts of time, as they are actually undead. Mousselon was once home to great knights, but is now nothing but a land of shadows.
They used to have Grail knights, now they have Fail knights.
They have pretty cool, like, black knights and stuff, though. In fact, the bastard son of Luin Leon Kerr, or at least allegedly bastard son, I think in the end times, it's confirmed that he is. So, I don't know. Choose it. If you want to believe it, then sure, whatever. But the guy who's the ruler of the land, who's called the Black Knight, is allegedly the bastard son of Luin Leon Kerr. So, wacky. Bastogne is the dukedom which Giles himself hailed from and is at the heart of Bretonnia. It holds the cathedral of the cult of the lady and holds the most Grail Knights in all the kingdom. Unfortunately, not all the people are Grail Knights, and the residents of these lands are extremely arrogant. They still cling to the fact that their dukedom was made by Giles, and they believe themselves to be far superior to the rest of Bretonnia.
Yeah.
It is said that the peasants of Bastogne openly worship the lady. So that's neat. I guess they're allowed to.
And they're like, what are you going to do about it? The Green Knight will come and get you. He'll get you. Yeah. Let's do what we want. Look, he's well cool.
Yep. So I think there was a little quote that I saw just in response to something that some guy from Bastogne said. And then the other guy just says, okay, but who's the king now? And yeah.
There and then go. He was like.
Yeah. Well, my dad was Giles the Breton, so I'm better than you.
He hasn't been on the throne for several years. Well, it doesn't matter. Mine's the best one.
Bordeleau, I don't know if I've said it right at all in this podcast, but that's okay. It's the wine country of Bretonnia, and it shows. The general population is perpetually drunk.
And I was going to say, peasants... I'm loving the idea of Grail Knights completely sloshed on their horses and going, come here, you flash. Back you in my cup, you bastard. even the horse is like trotting along a little bit drunk. Just like,
That's awesome. Even the peasants here can afford the wine because it's so cheap. Not all the people here are alcoholics, though, and those who work hard... generally become experienced sailors, as Bordeleau has many ports and stuff like that. They thrive off of trade, similar to Le Anguille. The coastal people worship Manan, the sea god. Pretty neat. Paravon is another mountainous dukedom that divides Bretonnia and the Empire. The castles of this land are built high upon cliffs and mountaintops, and the dukedom is home to the largest concentration of Pegasi. So they have lots of Pegasus knights as well, which, as the name sounds, are just knights who ride Pegasus, which is... They're flying knights, can't go wrong with that.
Hmm.
The other part of its dukedom lies within Athol Lorn, and the wood elves have permitted the people to reside there. As a result, Paravoni people are known to be extremely cautious with their movements, not disturbing anything wherever they go anywhere. So naturally, if you're in Athol Lorn and you break a tree branch by accident,
yeah,
and you
have 50
arrows in your back.
You accidentally brush past a daffodil and some of the petals fall off. You're like, oh no, I've done a violation of our agreement. Oh no, I'm causing mayhem. And the elves are like, can't do that.
Yep. And the elves are merciless too, the wood elves. So they're crazy.
you trod on our petals, therefore we are going to flay you. Like, oh no, please. Yep. I'm already a peasant. I don't have much.
The populace, though, travels all across Paravon, and it is a tradition for the people to have ventured the entire dukedom throughout their lives. Again, making me wonder about the freedom of travel rules and if they are as strict as they are made out to seem. But maybe it's place-to-place basis, like I said. Aquitaine is simultaneously the most beautiful land of Bretonnia and the most violent. With a gentle and calm geography and no external threats, just like Lyonesse, the people resort to fighting each other. Feuds, revolutions, civil wars, and the likes are a constant, yet it also has made these people particularly strong and brave. The poor duke tries his best to resolve these conflicts, but it is an impossible task. Despite this, it is a jewel in Bretonnia, and any traveler would be lucky to see it. Quenelles is a large dukedom that has a nasty orc problem. The land envelops massive Orkel, a place that has held greenskins for many years. If you play Total War, that's the, and you play as Britonia, it's the one orc settlement just in the middle of Britonia that's just randomly sitting there. Some believe that the land is cursed by the long-lost dead that were killed by the orcs before, and the Quenellans hate the orcs probably just as much as the dwarves, which is saying a lot, because the dwarves hate more than probably anybody in Warhammer, so...
Other than maybe the Skaven. I want to say they hate them more, because they're like, you blew up our stuff! Ugh, yeah. I don't like you.
Mm-hmm. In fact, many Eventry knights seek to aid the dwarves in the eradication of the greenskins and take up arms with them. So there's a little dwarf and Bretonian collaboration. So
would it be fair to say they have better ties of friendship with the dwarves than, say, the Empire?
I don't know. It probably depends. I think the Empire is their greatest ally. Because, I mean, the dwarves, although they are really nice, they're still dwarves, so they're not, you know, they're not humans. They don't really share the same things. And the dwarves are still generally suspicious of everybody. But
especially the guys sipping on their grail. I was like, hello there, Pip. I don't know about you guys. You're a bit arrogant.
Britonia is the Empire's, or the Empire is Britonia's greatest ally and also greatest rival. So, naturally. I don't know if they've ever really fought for an extended amount of time before. I think they have fought, but not often. They're generally pretty nice. And especially with Lewin being the diplomat that he is, they're usually on good terms. So, that works. Brionne is another land of beauty with people who absolutely love art. They are obsessed with making the best, most gorgeous architecture, and so have the greatest and cleanest towns in the land. Unfortunately, at a whim, they may tear it all down and build it again to make it look better. They also sacrifice practicality for aesthetics, yet they live in a very safe place, so it's fine. It is a dukedom of romance and poetry, with love being a well-respected thing. Each citizen is a poet at heart, or at least they think they are, and it is a very dramatic place, with the politics being akin to a Shakespeare type of play, with, you know, love and affairs and all that stuff. Yeah. They're a fun bunch of fellas.
Yeah, with Duke and then at long last, in their history.
Yeah. Yep. Long last, we have Carcassonne, which is probably my favorite dukedom, and it holds potentially the most able peasants. They are very militaristic people who are constantly battling the orcs upon their southern border. Even the lowly peasants have been trained and are relatively skilled warriors. This naturally makes the knights of Carcassonne incredible fighters. The whole nation is made up of noblemen, whether peasant or lord, as they all, or of noblemen. It's two words, not one word. Whether peasant or lord, as they all strive to fight so that their nation does not have to. They have a love for art and poetry, as well as in, just like their neighbors, feeling such things close to their hearts, as these are the things that they may enjoy because they fight to maintain Britonia's safety and freedom. So, they're pretty awesome. And that's the dukedoms.
Nice.
Overall, that is a fairly, the fairly basic overview of Britonia as a whole.
Hmm. I mean, but again, I must say, even with that last bit, we were talking about the dukedom that's very into art and everything. I was just there going like, blood angels, blood angels, grails, art, being noble, immaterial being that saves them in their darkest hour of need.
I was worried that I had written too much, but I think that was a good length. So
yeah, that was good fun.
Yeah. Have I convinced you that Britonia is not so bad?
Yeah,
at least the slightest.
I mean, I'm intrigued to see about like how the Grail Knights operate in combat, because they just sound like so juiced up. Like yeah, like I guess I know you said Space Marines, but I feel like maybe is Custodes a bit more their level of like they're pretty much the apex human fighter, other than like named big characters like Gotrek or Felix, or who are like, oh, we've got some plot armor to help. and I like, here's the thing, because they are very much like, we're all chivalrous and we do all the, are they somewhat hampered by the stories that you can tell about them are very like, you can only do these specific things, and so you can't have a Grail Knight who forgoes chivalry and becomes like, oh, we don't talk about that guy, but he's also a legendary character in the setting because that's not what we're about. because I know you said there's only a few characters of like proper note, and when I've been doing, for example, characters like the Blood Angels, I did Astaroth the Grim, and I was like, oh, it's like he's pretty grim. Mm-hmm. But that's all he is. It's like, oh, there's not really not much to talk about. He's a grim guy, and I feel like that's the case with Britonia to an extent.
Yeah, they are slightly one dimensional. Like their entire history of Britonia is just them fighting battles and winning being the impossible glorious. Odds, just kind of over and over again. Yeah, there are some wacky characters though, like Merovich, the guy who drank the blood of the king.
Oh,
but yeah, I mean, they are slightly one dimensional. I'll admit that there is a story. I haven't read the book. I really would like to, but there's a story where a knight of Britonia travels through time in Athelorn and slays a dragon to save his wife, and that's it's a classic knightly tales like that.
Yeah. So. And his name was Royal George, King Royal George. He killed the dragon. Wink. Don't worry. There's no parallels. But if you were to start off with Britonia, if for example you're someone who's a newbie like me and you're like, I want to get into Britonia, would you suggest either a book or getting into the Total Warhammer games, or is there a good place to start?
I mean, finding the army book PDF online is the easiest to digest, naturally. I would really like to read more fantasy books. It's been a long time since I've really done any of that stuff. So I want to do a beginner to expert maybe someday after I've read like 5 Britonian novels, because I don't know if there's that many of them, but I'd love to read them. It looks like there is a Knights of Britonia omnibus, so that's kind of that's always a good place to start in Warhammer stuff, right? The omnibuses are very...
I've still got my Wordbearers omnibus that I haven't started. Yeah. And I've been working through the Blood Angels omnibus, and I'm about half. I'm like 600 pages out of 1,000 through it. And I'm like, oh, it's so good. But it's definitely like old Warhammer, where it's like, oh, they're still calling them legions when it's the Adeptus Astartes. And oh, it's a bit more gritty, but there's some really fun stories in them.
Yeah. So I unfortunately don't know too many books that I could recommend, but I think the omnibus is usually a good start for most things, right?
But other than that, as the local Britonia expert, I want to thank you for telling us about the Grail Knights and all their antics.
Thank you, Mr. Andy.
If you were to cap off the episode with a kind of pitch on why you think people should get into Britonia, do you have anything you'd like to say?
Sure, I think just Britonia has the coolest heroes in Warhammer, and when you have the bad bunch, but when you get to the good guys in Britonia, they're like really good guys, and they're very noble, honorable men, some of the best men in all of Warhammer, with some of the craziest deeds and most inspiring tales. And if you like like Knights of the Round Table type of stuff and that aesthetic, then is right up your alley, obviously. Just like Knights in general, the aesthetic is awesome. Like I said before, the Bionicle Mega Bloks Knights, you can't go wrong. So, yeah, overall, it's just beautiful. The people all work together. They're fairly unified, unless you live in, like, Leoness. I just really like how dedicated they are to the lady as well, naturally. And, it's nice. It's always fun to call your wife the Lady of the Lake and stuff, so... Might as well, try to be the questing knights in real life.
And you pay a lot of tax.
Don't worry about that part. If you're a knight, you don't have to pay as much tax. So
what are you going to spend it on anyway? You've got your horse, you've got your sword. Yep. You don't need anything else. Maybe a beer once in a while.
And it's kind of fun that they're dudes who have been just like blessed with divine power. They don't need guns or missiles or bombs and stuff like that. All the crazy other dwarves and empire men. They just have horses and good old-fashioned horses and lances, and they get the job done.
It just reminds me of that Skyrim meme of the boxer. It's just like, fool, Skyrim has guns, and it's just him with his arms out and his muscles. Like, yeah, really.
That's right. They have basically Space Marines in Warhammer Fantasy, so...
But not epic. Age of Sigmar Space Marines, the other ones.
That's right. Don't bring that up. They didn't even get to be in Age of Sigmar.
They're fan fiction. They're made up. It's a lie.
The Empire barely even exists. Like trick, ugh. Whatever. I don't know my Age of Sigmar lore very well. I just know that a lot of people speculated that Britonia got turned into the Flesh Eater courts, because the ghouls are all about how they think that they're like chivalrous, honorable knights, in like a beautiful land, but they're actually all crazy ghouls who are just schizos and stuff and
eating people. Yeah. Well, anyway, that was an absolutely lovely episode. I had a lot of fun learning about the Knights of Britannia. This is our last episode of the year, but I thought it'd be fitting. We've had a lot of requests for Britannia, but if anyone has any suggestions on what we could talk about next time, please let us know in the comments. It's been good to have Eli on Fireside this time. We've now all been on an episode. So maybe we can come back and do another discussion about something else in fantasy. We'll see. Mm-hmm. Have a think about what we could do. But other than that, thanks everyone for watching. And we'll catch you all on the next one. Bye, everyone.
Farewell. Love you. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.